Hello, hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer. Today, I'm joined by Mr. Terence Corrigan. Terence, how are you doing?
I'm okay, Nicholas. And yourself?
Yeah, I am doing pretty good, pretty good. It's a lovely day in Johannesburg. Nice and wet and windy and nice and cool. We're also joined by Mr. Michael Morris. Michael, how are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you. Speaking to you from my troglodytic cell. This is actually my workaday office. I normally speak to you on the show from indoors, but domestic arrangements are such that today I'm not able to. So forgive me for the not particularly good lighting, but otherwise all good.
As the comrades in the National Democratic Revolution camp say, a luta continua.
There we go.
All right. let us continue with our topic for today. And Terence, you wrote an article which is on the dailyfriend.co.za titled Am I Optimistic? And I thought this would be a really good opportunity to just talk about something I think a little bit more high level and not necessarily so sort of one specific incident or one specific story, which is the question of what it means to be optimistic about South Africa's future. Whether people have been wrong about being optimistic or pessimistic in the past, and just kind of how we as South Africans should think about the complicated and often difficult political environment that we find ourselves in. So, Terence, do you want to just run us quickly through what you said in your article?
Yeah, look, there are a couple of interesting developments lately. One of them is the published and approved framework on professionalizing the public service, which seems to suggest that that cadre deployment may be on the way out, or at least it's been unambiguously condemned by name in an official document. It didn't sort of skirt around it by saying, you know, political interferences in appointments or the political administrative interface, whatever. It said deployment, cadre deployment, and it placed it in contradistinction to the idea of merit. So it was quite extraordinary in the expression. The second thing was the finance minister saying that state-owned entities or government agencies that need to procure do not need to sort of wait for Treasury's approval. They have the latitude to do this, and this seemed to be a response to something that we have certainly been arguing, that preferential procurement needs to go. There's a limit to what any system can take, and it's a non-productive expenditure. And we are kind of sitting at a point of crisis. This may have been feasible back in 2006, but it's not feasible anymore. And today we've seen, last couple of days we've seen we've seen new regulations come out, which actually seems to dispense very significantly with the idea that you can disqualify people off the bat because they aren't appropriately racially owned. Then the third thing was the Eskom board member who said in an interview with the Sunday Times that preferential procurement, localization, those things also need to at least be vastly scaled back, if not dispensed with, and they need to be able to hire the right people. They need the skills. Now, all of these are perfectly commonsensical solutions, but for a long time, I think they were just unsayable. Now, I don't say that this means that the problems are about to evaporate, or there's been some change of heart. In fact, I explicitly say that I very much doubt that. But let's just say that the Overton window has opened. That at the very least, the negative impacts of these policies, you know, have been placed center stage. The idea that, you know, we're going to do better cadre deployment, which seems to have been the way that the ANC has been framing it ever since it started its corrupting work back in 1997, and you know, we're always going to, like, put, you know, the next round of cadres will be the cadres that make cadre deployment great again. The sort of mega cadre deployment. It is interesting to see that's not what's being proposed. Now, understand, this document is almost certainly written by civil servants and academics and consultants or whatever. In other words, people who are not in the power structure, but they've said it. They put that on the table. I note that the Eskom board backpedaled about how wonderful it finds localization and BEE and affirmative action and everything, but the problems with this with these systems can't be denied, and they've been placed on the table by somebody who ultimately will have to carry the can for them. And I think, am I optimistic? Not really, but I'm intrigued.
Yes, no, I think that's a great point. And this is you start your piece off with this, and it's also a point that our former boss, Franz Grenier, would often make, is how, things can sort of happen slowly and then suddenly. And the example he always used was for the dwindling, the twilight years of apartheid, where, if you were a person asking about how South Africa was going to be going in 1988, you might be a bit pessimistic about how things were looking. As you say in your piece, Terence, there was this diplomat who said, look, the country is doomed. It's heading for some kind of gruesome, violent civil war which no one will win, and it'll just destroy everything. And yet, a lot of violence, but the country didn't collapse and fall into violent civil war. Things got much better. Things improved. The economy grew. We saw reductions in unemployment. All sorts of good things happened. And then things turned again, just as we hit our World Cup and we had this great moment of sort of national triumph, and things started to get bad and corruption seeped into every single institution and all of the policy gains of previous years were reversed. And now it looks like we're heading for some kind of apocalypse. But once again, things may change. And as you say, the Overton window has been opened. Michael, what do you make of all this? I mean, you as a South African, how do you feel about your future in the country and whether you think your kids are going to grow up here?
In fact, that was the key thing that I wanted to talk about. But just before I do, I was just looking down at my sort of workspace here. I spotted a note that I made, in fact, just prior to the start of our podcast last Monday, a week ago. And I can't remember... I think we were actually talking about the Eskom board members' piece in the Sunday Times. That was really what it was, and I think it was perhaps something that Terence had written, perhaps in last Monday's Daily Friend, that drew attention to the fact that we're looking at with so many of these reforms sounding things that document approved by cabinet, for instance, we're looking at the wording of technocrats and managers, professionals, academics, people who are looking rationally at what the problem is, and so on. And the question that I sort of wrote down briefly on a sheet of paper in preparation for our chat last Monday was: have the politicians really bought into the new vision, or is this just professionals, technocrats, managers, and so on who can see what's wrong and how to fix it? So I think that's I'm echoing what Terence has repeated again now, that this is a question of watching closely and seeing whether this is going to materialize in a kind of real political form, or whether it's going to take a bit more nudging and pushing. But to come to your question about optimism, I often at dinner parties over the past, well, I suppose perhaps ever since I became a journalist at the beginning of the 80s, end of the 70s. At dinner parties, you will often be confronted with a question. You're assumed to sort of know stuff, and I don't think journalists really do. We tend to leech off people who do know, and it sounds as if we know what we're talking about. But people would often say, "So, Michael, are you optimistic about the country?" And I wasn't really able for much of my 40 years in writing release papers able to give a perfectly reasoned and credible answer, I don't think. But over the years, I did develop the sense of what I thought of as our one aspect of our national condition, and that was a kind of docility, which is it sounds like a rude word. It's a kind of rude you don't really want to use to refer to fellow citizens or yourself or to your society. But maybe a nicer way of saying it is that we're not a revolutionary society. And I really have felt that despite the history that we've had, and the very great conflicts that are very much a part of the fabric of South African society, and I'm talking over 300 years, we are in fact an astonishingly tolerant and patient society when it comes to getting what we really want. And I think, as much of our research shows, what most South Africans want is more or less the same stuff. We want stable living conditions. We want to be safe. We want to have jobs. We want to have a measure of say over how we live. We don't want too much meddling in what we do with our private time, and we want to have the choice to be what we see on TV and what we see on our cell phones. We want goodies. And I think that's kind of right across the board. There's that kind of general sense, but as to how people act on that, that's, I think, is a kind of not, our instincts seem to be non-revolutionary. We tend to be quite patient about it, maddeningly so, I think, sometimes. And yet that, I think, has shifted. I think there's a definite shift. We see it in commentary, a lot of commentators. There was one quite striking instance just the other day where somebody was a lawyer writing about goodness, I wish I could remember. I think it was actually writing perhaps about BEE. And the importance of race and so on, which obviously we contest. And this person was appearing to argue against people like us, the liberal point of view. But right at the end of his piece, he said, right, well, let's now get back to the real business of fighting the ANC, or tackling ANC indifference and cynicism and so on.
I think I remember what you're talking about.
Yes. And it was a very striking example for me. So I'm in a sense optimistic, but I'm looking at Terence's last line, and there are a lot of interesting things here. He says, am I optimistic? Not really. Am I skeptical? Certainly. But I am interested. I am intrigued. And I think that's an important thing. From skepticism, it's very easy to shift into cynicism. And once you become cynical, you are disaffected and actually disinterested, or uninterested. You're indifferent. But to be interested is to be, it's part of being skeptical, is that you're interested enough to be skeptical. You have a value, you have some hope, you have some expectation of how things could be. And I think that probably describes what I would think of as my kind of measured optimism. There's a great deal of skepticism. I think it's a kind of intelligent skepticism, but it is interested. I'm prepared to be involved, and so I'm prepared to stay. I think of myself as being somebody who's not going to think in terms of packing up and going overseas. I do kind of believe that there's something about South Africa that is capable of changing itself. Sorry, very long-winded way of getting to answering your question.
I asked you what I think was a question that demanded a long-winded answer. So thank you for giving one. I'm also often asked the same question by people. How's the country going?
Yeah.
And I think the truth is we are on a hinge moment where things can go either way. And you can see this in the policy responses and the ideas that are bubbling up into the public space now. On one hand, you've got all of these things saying, oh, we need to change the way we're doing things. We need to cut back on BEE. We need to change our procurement rules. We need to make more sensible, rational choices. We need to put power back in people's hands. We need to just let the economy go on with it and abandon these silly racial engineering schemes. And on the other hand, you've got an approach to say, we need to triple down on all of this. That's the only reason it hasn't worked, is we just haven't done it hard enough. And these are both responses to the emerging crisis that the current state of affairs has created. And it's only in a few years, I think, after our next election and seeing how the battle of ideas develops, that we're truly going to know what direction, what path South Africa has chosen. But even then, there's that famous cliche, there's no such thing as a one cause because there's no such thing as a lost cause. And I think that's probably very true about South Africa. Terence, final thoughts on this one?
Well, look, I just want to tell a little anecdote. I'm not sure if this is true or not, but I have used it before. Apparently, in 1923 in Munich, there was a sort of psychic who had a reputation for being able to predict things with uncanny accuracy. And so people went to him and said, "Tell us what Munich will be like over a period of years." And this is like 5, 10, 15, and 40. He said, "Okay." This is 1923, and in 5 years, Munich will be devastated. There'll be millions and millions of unemployed. We'll be in a dire situation. And he said, "And I can also tell you that we're going to have a leader who will proceed to murder millions and millions of people and plunge us into a war." So he said, "Okay, so in 15 years, we've got a major problem." He said, "No, what I see is people building building roadways and full employment while the rest of the world is struggling." Okay, so go up a couple of years. What do you see then? "Oh, I see tanks rolling against enemies and Germany fighting a war it can't win." All right, so 15 years, we're talking 1943. "The German flag will fly from the Arctic Circle to the deserts of Africa, from the Channel to the Volga River." Wow, okay, so 20 years. "Oh, Munich will be part of a Germany that's been shrunk to, a fraction of its former size, occupied by three different armies, and what you see here will all be rubble." In 40 years, we're finished. He says, "Oh, no, no. By that stage, the people in Munich will be earning incomes that we can't even dream of today. We will actually, be the allies of countries that we have fought against. In fact, their troops will be stationed here to protect us. And I can also tell you that if you go a few years beyond that, the whole country will be sitting in their living rooms looking at a little box in the corner that shows a man walking on the moon." Now, obviously, they locked him up as a madman.
Yeah. how insane that would all be. Anyway, I think interesting to think about, something that all South Africans should keep in mind is the future is a very uncertain place where many things, both good and bad, can happen. And consigning yourself either to naive optimism or to endless gloom, neither is a particularly helpful cynical gloom, as you pointed out, Michael. Neither is a particularly helpful strategy for dealing with life in a complicated country.
Yeah.
Okay.
And
go ahead, Michael.
I had one very small thing. I look at David's comment, kind of cautioning me not to let the EFF hear me, and presumably what he meant was to hear me saying that, we're not a revolutionary country. But I think the EFF might, I'm not an expert on electoral politics and as you and Terence certainly are, but the fact that the EFF is not this huge, wildly popular party with masses and masses of support, I think is an illustration of kind of what I was saying. One shouldn't tempt fate, but it doesn't look as though it's the kind of party that attracts masses and masses of support in a country which has such difficulties, material difficulties, as it does at the moment. Anyway.
No, definitely. Always something to keep in mind when one thinks about the way the country's going. Okay. Now, from the lofty and heady to the amusingly depressing, there's a great story in IOL. And, I really don't trust IOL. So I think every time they publish a story like this, it's almost always because there's some sort of ANC factional angle. But anyway, it's still a great story. The eThekwini municipality... Sorry, what's that, Terrence?
The 10 babies involved.
Not this time. So the eThekwini municipality has reportedly already spent 15 million rand on a change room and the digging of some trenches for a pool that is not even close to construction. This is according to, I believe, a report that was requested by a DA councillor in the eThekwini municipality, which found that there was a project to rebuild a swimming pool or to put in a swimming pool in Durban. And the project was originally supposed to cost 40 million. It soon ballooned to 80 million. And then the project ran over time. And the work that has been done is of shockingly low quality. Apparently, according to this DA councillor, the deep and shallow ends are on the wrong side where they're supposed to be. The change room interior of the 15 million rand change room was incomplete. And the roof was allegedly put on the wrong way. apparently the city of Itigwini has now taken the contract to the court over what it calls an incomplete job. I think that's putting it a bit mildly.
Oh, dear. I took the roof on the wrong way.
But this is just so illustrative of the kind of everyday corruption that goes on in municipalities across the country, of how there just seems to be no sort of... I mean, if this had not been brought to public attention, I wonder whether anyone would have said anything until such a time as the pool was built, and then someone hurt themselves jumping into the wrong end. I don't know. Michael, what do you make of this crazy story?
I mean, the first thing that strikes me is, you know, probably 20 years ago, if we saw a headline about 15 million spent on a change room and digging of trenches for a pool, which is, you know, everything's wrong, we'd have been absolutely shattered. But isn't it shocking that 15 million seems such a small sum today compared to the vast sums that are either stolen or channeled off into private companies and so on? But nevertheless, you know, it's taxpayers' money, and what a pathetic state of affairs. I wish you'd be grateful that there is at least a news report about it. You know, how on earth do you get it so wrong? As Darren says, how on earth do you put a roof on the wrong way? And, you know, it might have been aligned wrongly, but perhaps upside down. Perhaps they thought it was the pool. Who knows?
Terence, you know, this is an issue that some people have mentioned over the years. People like vary from all political backgrounds, including, I think, Helen Zille at some point, is that we've got an enormous number of regulations in the country that are supposed to stop things like this, right? We've got the Municipal Financial Management Act, which has a whole raft of things that need to be done in order to make sure there's no corruption in any deals. And this means that if you follow the rules, you have to do an enormous amount of paperwork and a laborious process, and anything takes ages and ages to do. But at the same time, it also doesn't seem to have much of an effect in actually reducing some of the problems that we have on a corruption with corruption in municipalities. What do you make of this story?
What do I make of it? I just can't get past the putting the roof on backwards. You know, if you're spending 50 million bucks on change rooms, I mean, you should be able to open like a movie theater or something inside it. And you dug three trenches. I mean, I'm telling you, you could go to these chaps who panhandle on the side of the road, get a bunch of them together. They'll do that in a day. You know, you can give them like five grand each, and they'll be, you know, over the moon with the money, and you got your trenches. But look, I understand that in certain institutions and in certain parts of this great republic, corruption is a kind of next level thing. So yes, as the script writer of Jurassic Park once said, you know, life will find a way. Well, so will corruption, sadly. I noticed that one of our viewers said that because the beaches are all E. coli up, and they're opening municipal pools for the holiday season. You know, it does say something that those pools weren't open in the first place. But secondly, you know, you have this stream of people from the great hinterland going down to Durban, you know, for beaches, not for, you know, half completed swimming pools. Its edge probably isn't that great. But you know, you see how misgovernance just, you know, knocks on and sort of kicks all those other skittles out. It's quite tragic. Actually, it's very tragic. Mm. Mm-hmm. And you know, just geographically, yeah. it can't afford that. You know, it's from sea level up to what, 500 meters or whatever. It's lots of hills. You need proper engineering to make a place like that work.
Yeah,
Michael.
I was just going to say, Terence, that you know, the sort of underlying theme here is something you've been writing about a lot lately, which is the cadre deployment, and you know, the absence of professionalized civil service, which is what we need, has been completely undone by a set of parameters which is almost guaranteed that you're going to get the wrong people signing off on things and trying to do projects and so on. So, yeah, it is a tragedy.
You know, just one more thing.
Oh, go ahead.
We were talking about staying or going or whatever. Apparently, if you're a qualified engineer and you have Durban on your CV, that is recognized the world over because of the engineering challenges. So there are lots and lots of places around the world that will, you know, snap you up in a second. Because if you can work there, you can work anywhere.
Interesting.
Something to keep in mind. For our last story, let's just quickly talk about some money that South Africa is getting from the World Bank. South Africa is going to be receiving at least 9 billion rand in the form of a loan to turn the former coal power station, Komati Station, which was decommissioned relatively recently because it was quite old and not super functional, to be converted into a renewable power station. It's going to have 150 megawatts of solar, 70 megawatts of wind, and 115 megawatts of storage batteries for when the sun isn't shining or the wind is not blowing. The World Bank funding will be financed through an 8 billion rand loan, an 870 million concessional loan from the Canadian World Bank Clean Energy and Forest Climbing Facility, and an 183 million rand grant from the World Bank's Energy Sector Management Assistance Program. This was hailed by Pravin Gordhan as a great step forward, saying this project will greatly assist Eskom, South Africa, and the international community to develop a deeper understanding and appreciation of how the processes of decommissioning and repurposing of coal power stations can be done in a manner which mitigates the socioeconomic impacts of workers and communities before we scale up the move of the power station into a low-carbon path. Critically, it will provide training in new skills and for new jobs. Always nice to get money from overseas. Terence, what do you make of the story?
Presumably, if it's a loan, you have to pay that back at some point. So, you know, it would be good to spend it on the purposes for which it is intended. You know, I think that what I see there, I think in an ideal world, it's great if you can use this to create jobs and create skills and whatever. But beware that becomes the kind of focus of what you're doing, because, you know, there's many, many ways to skin a cat. What you need fundamentally is something that produces power. I'm all for renewables and, you know, a power station that was commissioned in 1961, you know, probably is at the end of its lifestyle, a life cycle. So let's do something new. But At the end of the day, that has to be the outcome, not, you know, people with certificates. Those are all, in a sense, nice to haves.
Now, I personally am a complete monster who, you know, doesn't really like renewables that much. But what I do like is nuclear power, and I'm endlessly frustrated by South Africa's sort of unwillingness to talk about nuclear power, except through the prism of buying very expensive power plants from the Russians that are clearly in corrupt deals to fund certain factions. Right now, as we speak, there's a lot of talk and innovation about, for example, developing much smaller modular nuclear reactors, things like that, which would bring the cost of producing a nuclear power plant way down, and allow us maybe to supplement things. Michael, what do you make of all this?
I certainly agree with Terence. You know, the thing here, the risk is this kind of creeping focus away from producing power to all sorts of other funny things. And one of those is this phrase in his statement that this is going to greatly assist not only Eskom South Africa, but also the international community to develop a deeper understanding and appreciation of how the process of decommissioning, et cetera, can be done. You know, do we really need all these hundreds of millions? What was the total sum? 9 billion to develop an understanding about this. Well, I think it is important, as Terence says, nice to know that, you know, there is a possibility of reusing these things and having a, you know, outcomes which might be of benefit to us, but it does all seem a little risky. Depends who's going to do it, where the money ends up. Our record is not so good.
I wonder if the World Bank is going to ask for the receipts in 2 years, because everything seems to have disappeared.
Find the receipts in 2 years' time.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's a shame. Okay. I think we are pretty close to time here. I see there's a lot of interesting comments here about my comments on nuclear power, but I don't know if you have time to properly address those. But yeah, no, something I think definitely to keep in mind. Thank you very much, everyone, for listening. We hope that you found the show interesting. Please give us a like if you're watching on YouTube. Give us a nice review if you're watching on, if you're listening to us on one of the podcast apps. And we will be back tomorrow on the Daily Friend Show. Just a reminder, we will be closing just around, I think, the 1st of December. We will no longer have a show. We will be back in January of next year. So we hope that you all have a wonderful time, and we'll see you tomorrow. Cheers.